Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is Thursday, September the 18th, 2025. And this is episode 3734 of the Survival Podcast. And as I sit here and look at the screen, I am reminded that Thursdays are always expert counsel Q&A shows, unless something preempts them, which is very unusual because, well, I love doing these shows, and let's be honest, it's my easiest day of the week because I only have to, like, link them all together and do one short segment instead of a whole show or an interview. Today I got a really great lineup, and I am fat and happy with content from the expert council. I just sent out an email to everybody on the council saying, hey man, if you don't hear yourself on the show today, you didn't do anything wrong. I just for once have an abundance. The piker tree rained down upon me expert council segments. It's summer is over, the piking is over, everybody's back to content creation, except a couple of you, and you know who you are. I told everybody today to be like Andy McCann. You won't hear from him today, but I have enough content from Andy to handle shows with him in it from now until Turkey Day. Be like Andy if you're a council member. I'll also throw this out. I am open, always open, to adding to the expert council. If you want to be on the expert council, here's what you do. You send me a little email. You tell me about yourself in like a paragraph, not a book. If there's more I can find out about you online, if I'm interested in it, you give me a link to that. Or two links or whatever. But the big thing you do is you record for me a 5 to 7 minute segment as if it was for the council. I might even use it to give you a trial. That's the most important part to me. One, you know what the hell you're talking about, and two, you're good at it. It's not like, you know, trying out for parkour or football. It's like trying out for the varsity team. You can be cut and you may not make it in the first place. That's how it works, because it has to be. This is a professional thing, and we have top-notch people here. What top-notch people, and what are they talking about today? We have a rare solo from Ron Paul. Ron Paul is usually either accompanied by Chris Rossini, Dan McAdams, or both in our segments. This is just Ron Paul speaking out about the Charlie Kirk shooting. Chris over there said, I think this is the most important thing we did this week. I would agree, so we'll hear from Dr. Paul on that. Nicole Sauce will talk about long-term lifestyle over short-term cash. I actually have a term for this, and now I'm thinking that this needs to get worked into my new book, Laws of Life 2. I call it investing in life. Investing in life, like in your own life. And it's a really good take that she has on it, and maybe I'll expand a little bit. Joel Riles has a segment for us on dogs, of course, but this is on combining your dog's exercise with obedience training. Very important. Always be training, ABTs, right? Matt Sersley will talk about how new tax laws affect 529A plans and homeschool. I am on record for 17 years now of saying they are the devil, I hate them, they are despicable, they should not exist. Matt says I'm wrong, finally. He doesn't say I was wrong last year or 10 years ago. He says I'm wrong now in a new opportunity that comes up with them under some tax changes as regards homeschooling. I'll listen. I'm not fully convinced yet. Maybe it's a good way to salvage things if you already set one up. I believe there are better ways to tax defer investments than 529s with more flexibility, but let's see how this goes. Michael Melito, he's going to do something I've been thinking about doing myself. He's going to talk about the ballistics of the Kirk shooting versus the conspiracy nonsense. There's a lot of stupid shit going on right now. Like Charlie Kirk was wearing body armor and a bullet hit his vest and then it cut his neck and that's how he really died. And they're not telling us because that will reveal the existence of the NASA Juice Space Laser Penguins. Which makes no sense. Why would they hide that? What would they gain from that? You know what you don't have when you're wearing ballistic armor? Man nipples sticking through your thin ass shirt. But there's something more important about this. You know what doesn't stop at 30.06? Like the typical bulletproof vest that a cop wears, right? Your level one, level two armor doesn't do it. You need heavy trauma plates to stop something like a 30.06 round. Very heavy. To even think of, like, a normal bulletproof vest as you think of it, a 30.06 will go through it, through a person, and out the backside of it. That's what will happen. I'm thinking about doing a video, maybe following up what Mike's going to talk about. I haven't listened to it yet, but I already know, because he knows his shit, where he's going to go with this. I have a vest capable of stopping 30 cal rounds. I guess I need to do a video with it and just show it. Do you think you can put this underneath a lightweight shirt like Kirk was wearing and not have it like print to god all awful end, let alone move around the way he was moving around and not sweat your ever loving face off in the heat of the Utah sun? It's ridiculous. And again, for what reason? I know. It's the NASA Jew Space Laser Penguins. They're really behind it. We're gonna kill that today with Mike. And I don't even know what he's gonna say, and I already know he's gonna murder it all the way dead into the ground like a vampire in the grave with a stake in the heart and a freaking silver bullet through the heart of the werewolf or whatever else it is, right? Jesse Markowitz will talk about getting started with computer backups and why you need to, and you do. And then I'm gonna talk to you about something that's coming and circling right now. The left always does this. So the left just committed an amazing act of political violence. We all know what it was, okay? Then they tried to spin it to, but he was really not left. He was a MAGA. When that failed, now it's really a love story between two confused young men. And they're not confused because they're gay or because they're trans. They're confused because it's like Romeo and Juliet in the modern times. No, it's political freaking violence. So what is the lead story from the left right now? Actually, you know, fat guy sticking his glasses up with his finger on his nose. Well, actually, it's really the right, and we have a proof of it in the statistics that the right commits more acts of political violence than the left. There's a book that Bill Gates is very fond of. It's called Lying with Statistics. We'll talk a little bit about that today. And we'll tie it back into the show I did on Tuesday, or was it Monday? Whatever day it was, Rules for Radicals for the Right. Because we're not learning on the right. And I hate to call myself on the right, but we are in a position of polarity at this point. We really are. And the main ideals of the political right line up very well with the main ideals of libertarians and anarchists, whether you believe that or not, from a standpoint of fiscal conservatism, and also from a standpoint of leave me the F alone. The average conservative has far less concern about what you do in your private life than you think. But the problem is, we're continuing to play by the rules we think are the right rules, while they lie and twist and deny and ignore reality. We're like, oh no, we need to explain it fully. I'm going to tell you today why explaining it fully doesn't work and why so many people believe the bullshit I'm going to explain to you. And then see if we can take something from that to use in our own lives going forward. With that, I want to remind you guys real quick, if you have not yet picked up a copy of Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by me, myself, and I, Jack Spirico, you should. If you have picked one up, buy another one, give it to somebody, right? If you have the one with all the typos and shit in it that first came out because of a mess up, I can't see anybody getting one of those anymore. Everything I've ordered from author's copies lately has all been corrected. Get yourself another copy. Then you have the collector's item and the proper one. Oh, and give some away. Give some away. If you have a young person in your life and you think they need some guidance and they won't listen, maybe they'll read. Get them a copy. Give it to them. Books stick around. That's why it could not just be an electronic copy when I put this out. It had to be a hard copy, because when you give somebody a hard copy book, even if they're not ready to read it, if they throw it somewhere and then one day they look at it and they're bored and they pick it up and they start reading, it's worth investing in the life of a young person to put that book in their hand. I promise you, I would have paid three times what it cost to buy it when I had no money when I was 20 to learn for myself in the future. To me, it really is like it's a book for everyone, but my hope is that it's a gift for the youth who still have so much time ahead and so much to build with, and so many are squandering it, and I don't want that. I want people to know what they need to know to make the most of the amazing opportunity that they have, because it's still an amazing opportunity. In fact, in some ways, today's opportunity is far greater than it was 30 years ago when I started. With that, let's go ahead and drop on in. Oh, wait, real quick. Last call. It's closing time. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. It's not really that way. It's closing time for sales for the TSP workshop in November. That will completely close down on Friday. But Jack, you didn't sell out. Why wouldn't you just keep ticket sales? No, because I don't do that shit, okay? Because I build my events to the attendance, and that makes us make sure we are always spot on with taking care of people. And that means I need a hard number to make decisions with going forward with catering and everything else. And that means on Friday night, that the order form will go away. And when you say on Saturday, but I needed one more day, I'm going to say, I am sorry. Wah, wah. I'm serious. It is not marketing. It is not a ploy. We still have some room. If you would like to come, you can. I've had several people ask about bringing kids. This is my rule on that. Some have asked with kids as young as 12. I'm open to that. I'm going to tell you, this is not a place to bring a five-year-old unless your wife is coming, you're camping, and they're going to do other things during the day. That is not going to work out. Paying $600 for a five-year-old to sit through stuff they don't want to listen to, not a good idea. If you think your kid would enjoy being there, would pay attention, if you think it's worth the investment in them to have them there with you, I really don't have a hard limit on age anymore because it's not my house. Okay? But you are responsible for them. Additionally, I have heard from a couple people about RVs. I remember RVs under 22 feet. I have a hard limit on the number. I have more spaces. You can't just show up with one. I have to know in advance that you have one. If you want one of the spots for an RV, 22 foot or under, email me and we will take care of that. With that, let's go ahead, drop in and hear from Dr. Paul on the Charlie Kirk shooting.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Ron Paul Weekly Report. Who killed Charlie Kirk? I had the pleasure of appearing on Charlie Kirk's program a few times over the years, and I always found him to be polite, respectful, and genuinely interested in ideas. Even in areas where we might not have agreed, he listened carefully. He was a strong advocate of free speech, and he made a career of trying to convince the youth of the value of free speech and dialogue regardless of political differences. At the young age of 31 years old, he had already founded and ran the largest conservative youth organization in the country, and as such, he had enormous influence over the future of the conservative movement and even the Republican Party. As I discovered during my Republican presidential runs, the youth of this country are truly inspired by the ideas of liberty, peace, and prosperity. I do not believe we have anything near the real story about the horrific murder of Charlie Kirk last week. The narrative presented by the FBI and other government agencies is wildly contradictory, with an ever-changing plot line that makes little sense. Some individuals close to Kirk have reported that his foreign policy position was shifting away from the standard neoconservative militarism in favor of a more non-interventionist approach. Tucker Carlson recently recounted that Kirk had even gone personally to the White House to urge President Trump to refuse to take military action against Iran. He was rebuffed by President Trump, Carlson informed us. Likewise, conservative podcaster Candace Owens, who was a close friend of Charlie Kirk, has stated on her program that Kirk was undergoing a spiritual crisis and was turning away from his past embrace of militarism and in favor of America First non-interventionism, particularly regarding the current unrest in the Middle East. Was Charlie Kirk murdered? Directly or indirectly, by powerful forces who could not tolerate such a shift in views in such an influential leader? We don't know. If anything, those seeking to prevent the ideas of peace from breaking out would wish to cover it up, as they have done in so many past political killings. As I recounted in my most recent book, The Surreptitious Coup, Who Stole Western Civilization? The turbulent 1960s saw several killings of major U.S. figures, including JFK, RFK, Martin Luther King, who were challenging the status quo and pushing for a shift away from the Cold War confrontational mentality. The real assassins of these peace leaders from last century were nihilists who did not believe in truth. They only believed in power, the power that comes from the barrel of a gun. Rather than compete in the marketplace of ideas, they preferred to snuff out any challenges and therefore decapitate any possibility that our country could take a different course. More than 60 years after the murder of President Kennedy, the vast majority of the American people do not believe the official story of how he was killed and why. Truth will eventually break through even when the wall of lies seems impenetrable. If it is true that Charlie Kirk was preparing to shift his organization toward a foreign policy embraced by our founders, the killing was even more tragic. But no army or assassin can stop an idea whose time has come. That may be his most important legacy. Rest in peace.
So my only issues with Dr. Paul here is that he seems pretty open to the idea that, you know, Israel did it. I think that what happened, and this was done fairly early this week. We know a lot more now than we did then. I think it's fairly obvious that the guy that they say shot him, shot him. I think it's fairly obvious he shot him with a rifle that belonged to his grandfather, that the family has had for a long time. I don't think this is complicated. I do think that Charlie Kirk was actually beginning to move. I would actually call it more to the conservative way of thinking, the true conservative. And the true conservative, in many ways, is also a classic liberal believing in non-intervention and beginning to slide away from the Israel narrative. That's absolutely true. However, I don't think that means that somehow, I don't know, somebody took control of this Tyler kid with a space laser or something. I think the machine got Charlie killed, and the machine aims to get people killed, and the machine knows when people get killed, it will have cover fire. That also seems to be changing. So I'll leave it at that, but it's pretty obvious what happened here. The man was shot in the throat with a .30-06. And the result was exactly what you would expect from a .30-06, if you know anything about ballistics, which Mike Melito will cover for us later. I also do agree, though, completely with the conclusion. The more Kirk was moving in that direction, the more tragic the loss really is. And someone can be happy for your death but not responsible for it. And someone can certainly pretend that it's a big problem for them when it isn't. Don't take this as Jack Spirko trusting Israel, because I don't. Don't take this as Jack Spirko saying they're not willing to kill people, because they are. They've as much stated so in public, let alone the evidence that they've done it in the past. However, here, a sick, twisted young mind was driven to murder by programming. And there is a temptation in these situations to always make it something more. Because there was something more to JFK, there must be something more to Charlie Kirk. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. And the main reason people want it to be that way, as I said earlier this week, if what just happened is exactly what it looks like, it means that any random clown can kill you at any minute on any given day, and that's very hard to accept. However, it is reality. Now let's talk about, instead of death, life. Investing in your lifestyle long-term versus short-term cash with Nicole Sauce.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Hollow Roast Coffee. And we're doing part two in the resilience series. The whole point of this is to talk about how we can build resilience through trying times. And since the last segment, things have gotten a little bit more trying. So hopefully you'll find this useful. And it's pretty much this. Have you ever found yourself so busy building a better life that you forget to live the better life? Anybody guilty of that at all? I did that in August. I went all in on my Hollow Roast business by having, it wasn't a booth, but a tasting corner at the Tennessee State Fair. It was great exposure. The Tennessee State Fair went on for 10 very long days, and it was very hot, and it was great networking. But at the same time, I was launching the Base Camp Lodge classes and Airbnb and doing this really awesome Curds and Connections class with Chef Ken. I was finalizing the Self-Reliance Festival speaker and demo list. I was going on other podcasts to be on interviews, kind of dealing with the post fallout from helping my mom recover from knee replacement. And I thought it was a good idea to host a meetup during that 10-day period of time. And it all meant it all landed in 1 week. And the cherry on top of all of that is I gave a talk about building abundance, not burnout, while totally burned out at a local mag meetup. So what did I learn from this? I'm not sure I learned anything, if I'm completely honest, but I know what I should have learned, and I will share that with you. I think building the life you choose isn't just about going all in, and I've known this for a long time, and yet we often find ourselves going back to old habits. It's about what you're doing every day. Consistency beats intensity every time. And we've heard this discussed in relationship to exercise from Andy McCann, right? It's better to do lower intensity exercise every single day than really high intensity exercise once a week. So I knew this. I knew this going in, and I teach this, and I still have to relearn it from time to time the hard way. And really what saved me during the crunch wasn't really willpower or being able to work many, many hours back to back. It was systems, as we talked about last time, and habits. Every morning, I take time to walk my dogs. And every day, I write in my journal for about 5 minutes, just anything free-flowing coming from my mind. And then I choose my three things. That's it. Those two things are what kept me grounded and almost sane. I'm not going to say sane, but almost sane. When the rest of my life was one drive to the state fair / segment / marketing effort / event away from each other day to day. That 10-minute walk or 20-minute walk I took every morning and that 5 minutes of writing in the journal really helped me think clearer, work smarter, and notice that while it looked like I was about to fall off a burnout cliff, I actually didn't have to if I didn't just do everything I always do all the time in addition to all the things I had decided should be done that month. I really think the thing that saved my bacon on that regard was using the My Three Things method to choose my priorities. At night, I would journal. I would choose three things that really mattered for tomorrow. And if tasting coffee at the state fair was one of those things, that was one of those things. There's only two spots left. Not 20, not 12, not 5, not 3 and 3, just maximum of 3. And when it was a day when I only thought I could do one thing, like the Curds and Connection Cheese class was a one thing sort of day, I just wrote down one. Then the next morning, I would journal after my walk, check the three things from yesterday against what I thought I was really needing to do after having some time after sleep to think about it, what was on deck, what was deliverable, where I had to be successful that day. And then I would edit the three things before I started my work day. That tiny system cut through a lot of chaos for me. And over time, those small wins stack up. And that's how abundance is built. It's one decision or habit, one step at a time. A little bit every day makes a much bigger difference than everything all at once. I will say in August, mistakes were made. Mistakes were made with my schedule. I think where people really go wrong as they endeavor to build through hard times, and I say this with love for y'all, and I say this with love for myself as well, because I've done all of them, and I probably will do some of them again. They chase the short-term dollar instead of the long-term lifestyle. What do I mean by that? If you're always chasing the short-term dollar because you're feeling kind of stressed out about money or whatever it is, or this seems like a really big, quick turnaround opportunity, you miss having the time to invest in the long-term payoff, whether it be financial or something you want to change about your life. Like, oh, I don't know, having time in your day every day to have a meal with your family at night, or being able to move out on the homestead and actually enjoy being on the homestead. There's lots of different things that may be your priority, but if you never make time for the priority, it will never happen. They say yes to everything. I'm so guilty of this. And wonder then why they're exhausted, right? They never stop to ask, is this actually working for me? So you start, you're all excited. You start the thing, you're working on the thing. A year later, have you ever once asked, is what I'm doing working for me? Do I even like this? If it's not working, do I need to change something to make it work? Or did I just discover I don't like something and now I'm building a whole empire around something I don't like? That one's really important. Very important to spend some time reflecting on that. They confuse motion with progress, meaning that they're busy all the time, all day long, working till the nth hour, getting up as early as they can, but they're just doing things because it feels good to do things rather than doing the things that are moving their life or their business forward. And then they grind on stuff they hate. Now, we all need to do some things we don't like in order to build what we need to build, right? Or maybe you're like the super person who doesn't, but it's very rare that that happens. And I call that eating a frog. Every so often, I just need to eat a frog in order to get past something to move forward. But if what you're doing every day is what you hate, you're probably not doing the right things for your purpose, and you're probably not doing the right things for the success of your business. So getting clear on that and realigning is super important. And in order to do that, you have to build space. Without space, you don't get the perspective. We all know that Jack goes on vacations from time to time, and he, like I, takes that week off between Christmas and New Year's just to get new perspective and set up for the whole new year that's coming in. So I think the thing to remember is you don't have to do it all. You just have to do the right things consistently, and over time it will build. And as it builds, it becomes easier to maintain that. So after that wonderful burnout 10-day period of time in August, I took a hard pause. I like took days, plural, off. I worked on the schedule and calendar for the base camp classes for the next 3 months, and now we're working on 2026, and got it printed and committed to and done. I mapped out all the real deadlines for the rest of the year, and then I stood back and kicked things out that didn't have to be there, didn't absolutely have to be there, so we could build in a margin. I take a day off every week. I know this is like shocking. I don't work 7 days a week anymore. I work six. I take a day off no matter what. Self-Reliance Festival is 2.5 weeks away, and I took Sunday off, and next week I take Monday off, and the week of Self-Reliance Festival, I might actually work 7 days, but I might take Sunday off. I don't know. I know that I'm doing my best to take one day off every week, though, because that gives me the space to have the perception in my brain of where the priorities really are and what things I'm doing that are just make work work, which doesn't really move you forward. And now I'm actually ahead. So this was just in August that all of these things sort of came to a head. I'm ahead of the game right now. I'm not perfect, but I'm in motion, and it's the right kind of motion. And I think that's what's really important. I also have learned to never end a meeting about putting something on my calendar, like a speaking engagement or a podcast interview, without actually physically putting it on my digital calendar. I know that sounds obvious, but sometimes when we get busy, we don't do that last step. And part of why my 10 days in August ended up so crazy is I said yes to the fair. I said yes to some class schedules. I said yes to some interviews. I said yes to a speaking engagement and looked at my calendar each time, but then didn't take the step to put the thing on my calendar, right? And then that meant that there were some potential double bookings. So I think if you're feeling stuck or burnt out or like you're always behind and the world's on fire and you really need to scramble to get through whatever's about to happen next in our culture, stop. This is what I'd say. Just stop. Start small. Write down something for tomorrow, like spend 5 minutes journaling or talking into your phone, and then choose three things you're going to do tomorrow. And then in the morning, take another 5 minutes, review that list, maybe write a little bit more, and choose, like, just update your three things to make sure it's three things that really matter. Then go on a walk for 10 minutes, come back and start. It won't fix everything, but it will start building the long-term life you want. Because if you're going to build resilience in your life, you need to build long-term resilience, not short-term payoffs. And that takes a focus further out than right now with everything going on with the Charlie Kirk stuff or with, I don't know, whatever the buzzword of tomorrow is going to be in the news. Separate from it, guys. And remember that consistency is going to win out over short-term burns every time. And if you can pair that with your ability to work hard, you'll go really far. If you want to meet some people who can help you do that, come on out to the Self-Reliance Festival in Camden, Tennessee, October 4th and 5th. Your ticket gets you tent camping for the weekend. We're going to have Dr. Ken Berry on deck. Alan Booker is running an SRF Teens program, which adults want to take after they've heard what's in it. We just had that conversation. And a whole bunch of other great speakers. Check it out, selfreliancefestival.com. If you use the coupon code SRF, tickets will be 20% off through the end of the day Monday. And if you want to sell something, because you're a vendor, we've decided after all of the stuff that happened last week, in order to facilitate better community building, we're going to give away vendor booths for free this year. So you just got to get your ticket and then sign up to be a vendor and you're good to go. With that, go out, make it a great week.
I completely agree with that. And yet, chapter one of my new book, Law One, do what you hate first and do it like you love it. Following that is a quote, those who sweat the most in peacetime bleed the least in war. Military proverb, origin debated. So how are these, and Nicole talked about it, she calls it eating the frog. I never refer it, that's a very old saying, and it's apt. I never refer it to that way because I actually like to eat frogs. For me, it would be like eating raw onion. I really don't want to do that. I don't really like raw. I suppose eating it like an apple, bleh, not good. I don't like raw onion. The key is the balance. If the thing that you have to do is something you hate, but it leads to what you want in life and what you love, then you eat the frog or the onion or however you want to put it, and you get it done. You do it first to get it done. That is my philosophy. But if all you're doing is what you hate, if you hate the whole thing, that you're doing the wrong thing. And if there's something that is repetitive in your business and you are always going to hate it, or there's something repetitive in your life and you're always going to hate it, either get rid of it or hire someone to do it for you. There was actually a time when I used to get my guys together back when I was with Neil Franklin and we were doing all these different companies, and one was the marketing firm. And we used to like just take these like fun brainstorming sessions and come up with ideas for companies. No matter, and it was like there is no stupid ideas. There were stupid ideas, Danny, if you're still out there. But we took the approach of there's no stupid ideas. And it was just to see if you took the gloves off completely and said go full contact, what can we come up with? And one time we came up with an idea that was like kind of like Fiverr, but for the things you don't want to do. And we were going to call it whycan'tsomebodyelsedoit.com. We actually got the idea from an episode of The Simpsons, right? Where Homer Simpson ran for sanitation commissioner, right? And it was not ever meant to be serious. But the idea was that why not outtask the things that you hate to do? Find somebody who needs money more than they need time and pay them to do it for you. Now, if this is clean the gick out of the bottom of your garbage can, it's probably not worth having somebody do that for you. But if there's, let's say, a series of tasks in your business that absolutely you hate to do, here's what you know you're never going to do. You're never going to do them fully consistently, and you're never going to do them to the best of your ability. And therefore, the need for them will be offset by the problematic way in which you failed to do the job with excellence. Especially if it's repetitive. It's like a weekly thing or something like that. Maybe it's something that somebody could do one day a month. Hire someone to do it or eliminate it. Life is too short to do things you hate beyond them as an end to a means. Now, there's plenty of shit I don't like to do that I do. But no one else can do it. It's not packageable into something. It doesn't take that long. It's not worth it. It's once a year. Things like that. Follow my law. Do what you hate first and do it like you love it. That's discipline. But beyond that, eliminate or hire. Those are your ways to make that part of your life better. Great segment from Nicole. Now, let's talk about doggies. One of my favorite things in the world are dogs. I love dogs. Joel Riles will talk about combining exercise and obedience training with your doggo.
Hello, TSP crew. This is Joel Riles with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you with another expert counsel segment. All right, I get a lot of questions about how much exercise does a Malinois, Dutch Shepherd, Working Line German Shepherd, how much exercise do these dogs need every day, and how do I go about giving them the exercise that they need? So the question then becomes, okay, well, if I don't need to exercise them every day, but they start to get a little squirrely, what kinds of things can I do if I'm not a runner, I'm not a, you know, I don't work out a lot, I don't do a lot of like high activity type of stuff, how do I give my dog some exercise if I feel like they need it? So here's my recommendation there. I always tell my clients, make everything an obedience exercise. So you can go out and have fun with your dog, but you make it an obedience exercise. The dog is going to have a lot of fun. They're going to enjoy it. It's going to be like, woo, to the dog. But it's going to build your bond with the dog, and it's going to continue to reinforce your obedience with the dog. So here's a simple way to play ball, like fetch, with your dog in a way that builds the bond, maintains obedience, and also gets the dog outside to run around and exercise if that's something you want to do. So if your dog is already chasing a ball, all I want to do is train the dog to go get the ball, to bring the ball back to me, and then when I take the dog, the ball out of the dog's mouth, I want the dog to release it, right? So I'm going to let the I'm going to confuse ball and dog a lot in this conversation. When I start this exercise off, I'm going to put a lead on the dog on a correction collar and just let him drag it behind him, so that if I need to reach over and give him a little correction, I can. I'm going to keep all these corrections light if possible, and I'm going to start close to me. So I'm going to toss the ball out. If the dog's excited about it, he runs and grabs it. Good, get it. And then if he's close enough, I might even hold the end of the lead and tell him, bring it. Now, sometimes they'll drop it when you do this because they're like, oh, I'm supposed to come to you, and they'll drop the ball. So I go, no, no, get it. And I encourage them to get it. Good, get it. When they pick it up, bring it to me. And sometimes I'll gently reel them in with the lead. I don't want to make them feel like they're getting corrected in this situation because I want them to bring me the ball back, right? Once I get him to bring me the ball back, I praise him up. I don't take the ball away right away. I praise him, good, bring it, good, bring it. And I give him some petting. And then I put my hand on the ball and I say, out. And if they don't out, I just give them a light little correction. Fooey that, out. Once they let go of the ball, I praise them. Good, bring it, good, out, atta boy. And then I get them ready to do it again. And then as they start getting this pattern down and I don't have to use the lead anymore, I start throwing it a little farther and a little farther. But the thing that the dog has to do every time in these exercises is they run and get the ball, then they have to bring it back to me, then I praise, and then they have to let me take the ball back. And if they start trying to resist me in any of those things, I put the lead back on. I'm like, no, 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 we're not playing this game. You have to do these things. We're going to have fun. We're going to play. But this is the pattern that you have to follow. Now, once I have that pattern down, right, that's the baseline for the rest of the exercise. Then we're going to start adding more intense obedience exercises into this. So the first one that I do is I hold the lead. I typically have them on like a 6-foot lead. I hold onto the lead good and firm because the dog might lunge out after the ball. Usually the first couple times I do this, they do lunge out after the ball. So I'm holding onto the lead. I hold the ball up so the dog can see it, and I say, leave it alone. And I throw the ball. Now, typically, if your dog's been really excited about getting the ball, they're going to lunge out, try and go get that ball. I'm going to hold on to the lead. They're going to correct themselves. When they hit the lead, I'm going to go, foos up. I said, leave it alone. I typically, when I start this exercise, have like 2 extra balls in my pocket. So I pull out another ball. I show it to the dog. I say, leave it alone. I throw it. They might jump a little bit on that one. I just give them a light little correction. Fooey, that foos up. Good foos. Leave it alone. I pull out the third ball. Leave it alone. I throw it. On whichever one of these I throw the ball and they actually stay in their position, right? That could be the first one. It could be the seventh one, right? But once I can throw the ball and they don't go chase it immediately, on the first bounce, I go, good, wait, go get it. And I let them go and get it while they're still seeing it moving, right? And then they run out, they get the ball, they bring it back, we praise, 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 and then we'll practice that a couple times. I'll typically go kind of collect up the other balls, stick them in my pockets, and we'll run that drill until when I say leave it, they wait until I throw the ball and I tell them they can go get it. So that's step one of like really putting obedience into this exercise. Once you've got them where they'll wait and you can throw a ball and then maybe good wait, and then you throw a second ball, oh, good wait, and then okay, go get this one, right? The key there, the reason that's important is if you're ever doing this in a public place or even in a neighborhood that you live in and you accidentally throw the ball somewhere that's dangerous for the dog to go get, like in the middle of the road with a car coming, if you say wait, that dog must wait, right? The ball can't drive the dog to break obedience. You have to have obedience that overrides the desire for the ball. Okay, and then the next step we're going to do, this is kind of the last step, is we're going to recall the dog while they're in the middle of chasing the ball. So how we set this exercise up is I use a long line, either a 30-foot or a 50-foot long line. If you don't have a quote-unquote long line, you can just get a piece of rope that's relatively strong from Lowe's with a snap clip and tie it on good and solid and then clip that onto the dog. You want it on their correction collar. And I'm going to be holding on to this, but they have that 50 or 30 feet before they get to the end of it. Now, the key here is I'm going to throw the ball. I'm going to tell the dog to go get it. And then as soon as I say, you know, go get it, leave it, let's go. If you do not do that instantly and they're already at the end of the lead before you say leave it, you're going to be unfair to the dog. You have to tell the dog to leave it with enough room left in the lead that they can stop and come back to you. Now, the first time, they're probably not going to do it. Now, I still have to be fair to the dog. I have to go, leave it, let's go. Now, I don't like saying, fooey it, let's go, because they're not doing anything wrong. Some people will defer to yelling out whatever their verbal correction is. I don't like doing that. I like giving the command, leave it, right? They're in the middle of chasing the ball. I go, leave it, let's go. And so in my mind, the ball is going toward a road, a car is coming, leave it, let's go, get back to me right now. Right, so that's what we're setting up here. Now, it's just building obedience and it's building discipline in the dog, but it's also there as a safety measure should I ever need it. And by continuing this exercise, when I say leave it, they should immediately stop and return to me. And then I'll praise them up. Oh, good, go, good, go, good, go. I grab another ball out of my pocket. Go get that one. And I'll let them run and get it that time. And I want to mix these up. Do not set patterns when you're doing this. Don't do like every third one, I let you go get it, blah, blah, blah. They will pick up those patterns right off the bat. You have to randomize it. I might do three where you have to wait, and then I do one where you get to go get it, and then I'll do three where you can go get it, and then I'll do one where you have to wait, and I just mix it up, right? It's just constantly varying it up so that the dog's not anticipating what's going to happen. They're waiting and listening to you, and they're following your commands, and they're being obedient when they need to be. All right, so that's a great way to get your dog out, to exercise your dog. You don't have to do a lot of physical activity, but you're building your bond and you're building your obedience with your dog and maintaining it throughout the dog's life. Dogs tend to love it if you get them into that, and it's a great way to just spend time with your dog. I hope that's been helpful for you. Remember, if you are looking for more training tips with your dog and you would like help getting them fully obedient, check out Canine Academy. Go over to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on the Canine Academy banner on Jack's website, and we have a bunch of different options for you to sign up there depending on how high you want to take your dog in obedience. If you're looking to purchase a working line puppy or a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com, and you can go over to our consult page and fill that out, and we will reach out to you and talk about what we can do to help you get more secure in your lifestyle. Remember, until next time, train hard and stay safe.
What I'll add to that is do it constantly, right? Like, build obedience training into everything and always be training your ABTs. And here's an example of that. My dog that I got from Joel, Belle, loves pets. She loves to get pets. And somehow we've come to this thing where if I'm gonna go into my bedroom and she's there and she wants pets and I'm willing to give her pets because you don't always get pets just because you want pets, I call her in and she jumps up on the bed and she sits there and that puts her head and my head about the same height and I give her behind the ear scratchies and stuff. I do it all the time. Come on here, get out there, sit, yeah, get some love. And then lay, dead, up, sit, down, meaning down off the bed, right? Sit, lay on the bed. Sit, paw, lay, dead. Loves. Like, just that. What that does is that conditions that dog that I am pleasing my human when I do the thing I'm asked to do when I'm asked to do it. And I have not listened yet, but Joel's got a whole series he's doing right now. And the next one I'm going to be playing for you probably next week is Emergency Plex. Now, Plex is basically lay and stay, right? It's a German. I don't use German commands like Joel does, but it's basically like you're there. You don't go anywhere. You don't do anything. You stay, right? I can see where that's going. And that's why I'm into this constant training so that when there is that need, you go, no, it is not questioned. It is immediately obeyed because it can be the difference between your dog harming someone or harming itself or harming someone else's pet or getting run over by a car or something like that. You know, so like one of my things is I have the command leave it like everybody does, but I also have that universal command that means don't touch it no matter what it is. At. And I'll throw food on the floor. At. I'll take the food and put it right in their face and go, at. I'll push it on their face. I mean, literally push a yummy treat against the nose. At. Don't you do it. Because I want that obedience. Not because, you know, treat them like a dog type thinking, you know, like I want to make sure that no harm ever comes to one of my animals because they were unable to control themselves when I saw danger and they didn't, because they can see and hear things we can never see and hear, but we understand things they can never understand. You have an incredibly athletic 4-year-old child in a dog, a 4-year-old child that can climb a fence. Okay, that's what a dog is, and it's very important that we keep that in mind in our training, and our training is as much for our own happiness as our dog's happiness, safety, and welfare. With that, let's hear about 529 plans and how some tax changes affect homeschooling in them. I'm interested in this because I hate the 529 plan.
Hey, TSP, this is Matthew Sersley with AgristTaxAdvice.com. Here to answer another community member question. The question is, as a homeschooling family, how can we take advantage of the updated 529 benefits that were included in the One Big Beautiful Bill? We've never been interested in these before because we have no idea if our kids are going to go to college. But now that you can do homeschooling or K-12 or some apprenticeship programs, it seems like it would operate more like an educational HSA plan, where we can set aside money now for known expenditures and then pull the money out tax-free to pay for them. What are the limitations? For example, we need a new computer, and the kids would use that for school, so could we use it for that? Could we pay for the gas to and from a field trip and the museum tickets? It seems like you could justify a wide variety of expenses for our children's education as a homeschooling family. Are there any ways we can take advantage of this that we haven't thought of, and are there ways we could get in trouble trying to take advantage? So first of all, until about 2 years ago, I hated 529 plans for almost anybody for most situations. But a 529 plan is a tax advantage savings plan designed to encourage saving for educational expenses. You invest after tax dollars at the federal level, so there is no tax deduction for this. But the money grows tax-free in the account if you invest it, and if you use it for the qualified expenses, the withdrawals are tax-free too. The downside is if you take the money out for anything that's not a qualified expense, you pay a 10% penalty on it. And so like you got no deduction for going in and now you're paying a penalty for coming out. It's really kind of terrible. First of all, it's really not something you should do before you take care of your own retirement and your own other expenses, your own investing, because it is so limited. Now, one thing I do want to go into before I go any further. This is all a federal law perspective. There are some states that offer some pretty good income tax credits for their state. So particularly Indiana appears to say for up to $7,500 per year put into the plan, you get a 20% tax credit on your state taxes. So that means if you put in that max, you can get $1,500 back on your state taxes. So if you're going to spend $7,500 a year on those expenses anyway, you might as well do this. In fact, it does appear in Indiana, you can literally put the money into the 529 plan today and then take it out for qualified expenses, maybe tuition for your private school tomorrow, and you just save $1,500. So that is a thing I would absolutely take advantage of, but check your state rules. Most states only give the credit or deductions on money that stays in for a certain time period. Some only give it for net increases. So if you put in $5,000 this year and then next year you take $5,000 out and put $5,000 in, no credit. Anyway, again, I want you, as a general rule, you got to take care of yourself first. We always hear on a plane, when the oxygen masks drop, you got to put your own mask on first before you help people around you. That applies to money and your financial future too. So I don't like putting money into a 529 plan until you've paid off any high interest debt, you've got emergency savings, and you're maxing out your own retirement, especially if you qualify for a Roth IRA. A 529 plan is going to help your kids probably, but a fully funded Roth IRA will help them way more if it keeps you from being a financial burden to them when you're older. Now, again, there have been big changes, some in 2024 and then even more in the 2025 in the One Big Beautiful Bill. So since 2024, you can now roll up to $35,000 from a 529 plan into a Roth IRA for the child, tax-free and penalty-free. Now, there are restrictions on this. The biggest one is the account has to have been open for at least 15 years, and the money moved still has to follow Roth IRA contribution limits. So they have to have earned income, etc. And I believe there's an age requirement on this. They have to be so old before they can do this as well. But it is at least one way to get this money out without paying that penalty. One Big Beautiful Bill, the two big changes is that homeschooling expenses are now officially included under the qualified K-12 educational expenses. And eventually, vocational and trade schools will count too. Now, I say eventually because as far as I know, there are no schools that qualify for this yet. They're going through a process. For quite a while, you've been able to use 529 plans for tuition at private K-12 schools. There are limits to that. It's currently $10,000 per year per student. That is going up to $20,000 per year per student in 2026 due to the One Big Beautiful Bill. And part of this, and you've always been able to do this, but it's easier now with the homeschooling, you can use this for books, supplies, and some equipment. So can you use it like an educational HSA? Well, kind of. So yes, you can use your 529 to pay for computers, tablets, or internet access if it is primarily for school use. So I'm buying a computer and my kids happen to use it for school. Not good enough. I have home internet access anyway. Not good enough. But, oh, I have to pay for a higher level plan or a faster plan for my kids to do their school. That difference is probably a qualified expense. You know, if your kids have a dedicated school computer or school tablet, and my eldest daughter is in an online school, and we have a dedicated device for her to use that has nothing else on it, so it's do your schoolwork or do nothing, that would absolutely qualify. Similarly, software for educational purposes. Buying Microsoft Office, probably not going to qualify unless you don't have it and your school requires things to be submitted in Microsoft formats. It will apply to the cost of your homeschool curriculum. And if you pay for online classes, tutors, or testing materials, it will apply for that as well. You cannot use the funds for everyday transportation. So gas for your field trips, probably not. You cannot use these funds for meals or snacks. You cannot use them for general home utilities, and you cannot use them for things like museum passes unless it's part of a formal curriculum or class. So if you're taking a science class and one of the assignments is to go to the Museum of Natural History, that qualifies. Or at least your kids' tickets qualify. Yours may or may not. But if it's not part of some formal thing, if it's not a required educational expense, you can't deduct it. It can't just feel educational. Now, that aside, it is a great idea if you know you're going to be spending money on this for curriculum, for materials, etc. You can put it aside, invest it, let it grow, and then pull it out tax-free. Again, you don't lose the money anymore if your kids don't go to college because, again, you can use it for the apprenticeship once they qualify with the Department of Labor, or you can roll it over into their Roth IRA when they're old enough. So it is a flexible plan. It can be a powerful tool. But again, it's not the first arrow in my financial quiver, as it were. Now, it's best typically to open the 529 plan in your name with your child as a beneficiary. If you have multiple children, you should open up multiple 529 plans. By doing this, you can change the beneficiary. So, you know, let's say one of your kids decides not to go to college, doesn't go to trade school, you can't use this, but maybe you have a grandchild. You can change that beneficiary. Maybe you have a niece or nephew who could use it, you want to give it to. By putting it in your own name, it's a lot more flexible. You know, make sure you're keeping really good records and receipts for this. The IRS does audit these far more often than something like an HSA or a regular retirement account. So you want to keep all your receipts. You want to keep very good records. You know, I do like these. If you know you're going to have the expenses, you might as well put them in. But the only real benefit is if you invest and make money in them, or you get some sort of state tax credit. So if you're just putting the money now and you're going to spend it next week, you just did a lot of paperwork for no good. So bottom line, 529 plans aren't just for college anymore and haven't been for a while. For homeschoolers, it can be a smart tax-free way to fund educational expenses, as long as you use it with discipline and as long as you take care of any of the options, especially state benefits that may exist. But again, this to me should be the last thing you fund in any sort of a savings plan, retirement plan. If you don't already have money set aside for an emergency, if you don't already have your retirement account set up and funding that, this is not something I think makes a lot of sense for you yet. Treat it like a targeted tool, not a dumping ground for long-term savings. Well, thanks so much. If you want this more information like this, please reach out to me at agristaxadvice.com/TSP. You'll get a great download with a whole lot of possible business deductions and some personal deductions too. And you'll get a chance to schedule an appointment with me if you want to chat about if I can help you personally save more taxes. Thanks so much.
So my opinion after listening to everything Matt had to say here is the situation's better than it was. You can make lemonade out of the lemons that is the 529 plan. If you already have one, all this advice is golden. I still would not do it. I would not. Let's look at why we're doing this, okay? We're doing this because we're saving for little Jimmy or Tammy's education in the future. And if it's done perfectly, we're starting when Jimmy or Tammy is a baby. They're still shitting their pants. They haven't even started holding their head up. As early as possible gives you about an 18-year on-ramp. Very few people actually do this. Even if you do, you have 18 years of interest in dividends to accumulate in your good years to offset your bad years of investing. And all you're saving is the tax on the gains. And in return for that, you're saddling yourself with all of these things, right? Now, if you're super wealthy and you're maxing it out or whatever, maybe this even might possibly be worth it if your kiddo takes a path that the 529 can do. If you're using it for homeschool and stuff, that's great, but do you need a tax-advantaged account to do that? Does it mean you don't have enough time, you know, if you're putting money in this year and you're taking it out 2 years from now for that tax advantage to matter on your gains? There's limits to what you can even hold in it. Like, to me, again, he kind of talked about how there's some Roth IRA type things that can be done and all, and that's good, and it's the same thing without the limits on it. And the thing about the Roth IRAs is that with a Roth IRA, I only pay interest and penalties on money that I didn't put in. If I put $10,000 in a Roth IRA, to just round it off, and I have a 50% ROI, so there's 15 grand in there, I can take out $10,000 and pay no interest and no penalties. I just have to fill the form out right. With a 529, if I have 15 grand stranded in there, I put 10 grand in, I have to pay interest and penalties on all the money coming out. Do you get it? So you're only protecting the gain, but you're subjecting the total to penalty. I'll tell you what. I'm the guy that doesn't tell another grown-ass man or woman what they need to do. I give you my advice, and then I say, do what you want. You better put all this dicky little shit into a spreadsheet, and you better be damn sure that it works out really well if everything goes the way you think it will, which is Tammy grows up and wants to go to Stanford. And then you better have contingencies for the fact that Tammy may not want to go to Stanford at all. I'm still no. It's a no from me, dog, going all the way back like 25 years with Randy on American Idol. It's a no from me, dog. But if you're already there, I think these things can help you get some of that money the hell out of there. That's my thoughts. I still hate them. I just hate them less. But hating less still equals hate. All right, next up, let's hear, and I'm interested to hear what Mike says about the ballistics involved. And I have a feeling he's going to go into some of the conspiracy theory stuff, too.
What is going on, TSP? I thought I would talk a little bit about the Charlie Kirk shooting from a ballistics standpoint. Jack didn't ask me to do this. I heard about what he was talking about on the Rules for the Radical Right episode. And I think Jack quoted scripture in that episode, so I'm going to. By the testimony of two or three witnesses, a matter is established. He didn't ask me to do this. I'm going to talk about the shot as we believe it happened, or as the evidence points to it happening. And real quick, the bona fides. I'm a state rifle and pistol champion. I was a West Coast regional rifle champion. Just polished off my competition shooting season this year. Expert rifleman in the Marine Corps. Professional firearms instructor. Military law enforcement. Private contracting experience. I just say that I've been blessed with that so I can share those experiences and knowledge with you guys to establish some street cred there. If the rifle was a 30-06, and yes, Mausers, it was one of the most common actions, and after the war, World War II, after World War I and World War II, they were cheap, and a lot of people customized them, and a lot of big companies would customize them and use those actions to make different things. And they came in a bunch of different calibers, from like 9.3x62 to 243, and a bunch of stuff in between, like the 30-06. They're not uncommon. 30-06 is one of the most common American sporting cartridges, and a lot of those guns were converted to that. So let's get that out of the way. And 30-06 was used to win more 1,000-yard competitions in the 20th century than I think any other round, just because it was around for so long. Now, whether the shot was 140 or 200 yards, but it doesn't really matter. That's well within the max point-blank range of that round, depending on if he's using 150 grain or 180 grain or whatever. Again, doesn't really matter. Those are minute details for this. It's still going to be within the max point-blank range. Max point-blank range, and for those of you not hip on the tactical lingo, point-blank does not mean like right in your face, which is the way that like Hollywood uses it. I'm not in Hollywood. I'm in the real world. Point-blank range for a rifle means the area of which I can aim at the target and hit the target without doing any adjustment on the sight or without holding high. That's your max point-blank range, meaning I can point at a dude and hit a dude, for this example. I can aim center mass and hit them somewhere acceptably in the target zone. The range for that in a 30-06 is somewhere around 275 yards, give or take a few yards, give or take, you know, humidity and a bunch of other weird factors, but it's not going to vary that much. 200 yards even is well within the max point blank range. It does not require any special training. The Marine Corps has riflemen, and this is predates optical sights. When I was in, we shot iron sights still. We shot man-sized targets up to 500 yards with no support, not resting the gun on anything, just your own body from the prone 500 yards. Memory serves, we start our qualification at 200 yards. And I routinely shoot CMP service rifle competitions. Our closest shot is 200 yards, and we shoot it standing without a sling, unsupported. And the target is way, way tinier than a human torso. It's a few inches for the 10 ring, and I routinely get 90-something percentiles. It's not some impossible shot. It's an easy shot. In fact, I was blessed last year to be able to teach my neighbor's daughter. Their parents are not really into guns, but they were supportive of her wanting to learn how to shoot. So I was like, whenever you hear me shoot, come out and shoot. She's 12, 13. She's 14 now. But when I taught her, I think she was in the 12, 13 transition zone. Anyway, pretty quickly, we had her shooting targets with a 22. And she would just for fun shoot a gong, way smaller than a man-sized target, from a kneeling position at 200 yards with a 22, which is way worse for wind and holder and everything else. But she would just do it just for fun, just shooting the 200-yard target. It's not a hard shot. It's not a hard shot with a 30-06 with a scope rifle. Not at all. So, not everything is a conspiracy. Could somebody have paid him? Could there be some weird thing behind it? I don't know. But the shot itself is not a hard shot. So, I just wanted to give a second witness on that for Jack. 140, 200 yards with a 30-06 scope rifle. Even if it was standing. But even if, better if he was kneeling or laying down prone or if he had a rest. I mean, it's not a hard shot. Now, the neck's a small target, but there's no reason to believe the person was aiming for the neck. He was probably aiming center mass and just happened to hit the neck for whatever reason. But again, it's not a hard shot. Not everything involves aliens and Bigfoot and conspiracies. Like, it could have just been a crazy dude that shot him. It happens. I don't pretend to be an expert in human psychology, but I think I could speak to the ballistics of it, and hopefully this was helpful if Jack even wants to include it as like an expert segment or plug it into anywhere else where it's germane. Thanks, TSP. Thanks, Jack. Have a blessed day.
Well, I agree with all that, and I have a few things to add. One thing I've seen is people sending around videos of something like the head of a ballistic gelatin torso model where they have like the cranium, like the full skull and a brain inside it and gel around it. You know what I'm talking about. And they shoot it with like a 30 cal, like a 308 or a 30-06 in the head. And it like, and I go, this is what would have really happened. This is a stupid person. You're seeing inside. That is what happens inside. The bones shatter, but the outside doesn't. And that shot is in the head, hitting the very hard bone skull, which causes massive expansion in a round traveling about 2,700 feet per second. Yeah? He didn't get hit there. He got hit in the neck. It's all soft tissue. You're going to get a pass-through shot. You're going to get a pass-through shot. And what you need to understand about shots that are pass-through that look on the outside like they're just holes doesn't mean that's what the inside looks out. I'll take it down to an arrow. Any archery hunter that's ever done a double long shot on a deer, no, especially a double long pass-through, you know, you break a rib or two maybe, but the arrow just ends up stuck in the ground and the deer runs away and dies. You look at the deer on the outside. You see a hole going in, a hole coming out, and blood came out of it. It's pink frothy blood because it's lung blood. You cut that deer open, and the lungs are jello. That spinning sharp blade did massive damage as it went through. When you know, poor Charlie Kirk got shot, and that round, moving at supersonic speed, passed through his neck, soft tissue, it did massive damage you did not see. Huge hydrostatic damage inside, which is part of why he died so quick. He probably had severe trauma, even if he didn't get hit in the neck vertebrae at all, which doesn't look like he did. He might have got nicked, but not a full-on hit. Still, that hydrostatic shock that close with that kind of round probably, gratefully, probably helped deaden some senses in those last final, you know, quarter of a second to a second that it took him to actually pass. Okay? If he got hit in the vertebrae and it actually severed it, then he was dead instantly. It's the same as being decapitated even though you weren't. You can be decapitated internally and it doesn't look like you are. That could have been what happened as well. But the real thing that bugs me here is not just the claim that the shot's hard, because it's not. And again, even when he keeps referring to 200 yards, the shot was not 200 yards. It was about 140 yards. I could make that shot offhand with iron sights with three whiskeys. I'm good as a shooter, but I'm not that good. I'm not a military sniper. I'm not at Mike's level or anything. This is not hard at all. But the whole mythology around the vest is odd, weird, and stupid, and it's just basically rage bait posting for attention seeking. I am going to do a video maybe next week showing what the type of vest you would need, because I own a couple of them actually, that you would need to potentially stop that level of ballistics. Because we don't know a lot of things. You know, was this a green tip armor piercing round? Why would he have that? Only a sat? No. There's a shitload of that stuff out there, especially among people that have surplus rifles. You used to be able to buy that shit for next to nothing back in the 70s and 80s. Nobody wanted it because it wasn't good for deer hunting. And lots of old grandpas have it in a chest somewhere still today. I'm just saying. We have no idea. But the terminal ballistics make sense. Someone hit in the neck from the side, you're going to have what looks like not much of an entry wound from a distance, from a picture. You're going to have a rather large exit wound. And if any major arteries or veins were hit in the neck on that pass-through, which they were, you're going to see a lot of blood on the exit side. Everything tracks ballistically here. And anybody that tells you it doesn't know anything about ballistics. They don't know anything. And if they're talking body armor, they don't know anything about body armor. They've never shot a deer. I've shot deer. When you skin them, the front arm falls off. You could put a football through the hole. And the hole in the hide, you stick your finger in. There's nothing unusual here about the performance of the ballistics or anything else or the difficulty of the shot. Thank you, Mike. Let's go on and hear from Jesse Markowitz about backups for your computer system.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz with YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today I have a question from Richard. Richard asks, I don't know much about computers, but I have a laptop using Windows, and I've never backed it up. I'm not quite sure where to even start. So Richard, don't feel bad about what you haven't done, but definitely listen here and get started with something. The first thing is, do not let the perfect prevent you from doing something good. So the most important thing is, to have a backup at all rather than trying to get the perfect backup strategy or whatever else. If it all seems overwhelming, start off with the default backup for your operating system and just store it in their cloud. Don't make it harder than it needs to be. For you, for Windows, if you just go to the Start window, search for Windows Backup, open it, sign in with your Microsoft account. If you don't have a Microsoft account, create a Microsoft account. Use their wizard to choose what you want to back up. You'll likely need a storage plan because Microsoft only gives you about 5 gigabytes for free. And if you have an issue after that, any of those files that you backed up, you can restore those files by signing in with your Microsoft account on a new PC or a friend's PC, whatever else. Similar, on the Apple ecosystem, on Mac, you can do the same type of thing. Go to System Preferences, Apple ID, iCloud. You turn on iCloud Drive. You check desktops and document folders. Turn on iCloud folder photos. And all of those things will automatically get backed up to iCloud. Again, iCloud only gives you 5 gigabytes for free, so you probably are going to need to buy a plan to store that extra stuff. Okay, either approach, just be aware that it's going to take some time for your files to sync from your local machine up into the cloud. It will depend upon what your internet connection is like. But if it were to take a couple hours or sometimes even a couple of days, depending on how much data you have, that would not be surprising. The important thing is get started soon. Now, if you're not overwhelmed yet, we can dive a little bit deeper. So, three things. The first one, step one, decide what you want to back up. The above solutions I talked about from default back up most of your information, but not necessarily everything. Kind of like a food journal, you can keep a data journal. So every time you work on your computer, either in a document on the computer or a little notepad on the side, just write down what files you're working with, what applications you're working with, so you can go back and see Where is that data stored? Is it already backed up? Or do you need to make sure it gets added in to your backup solution? Some of the things that sometimes will get stored in non-standard locations and therefore not be backed up by default might be things like locally stored emails, Bitcoin and other crypto wallets. Sometimes downloaded books, movies, pictures, anything like that may not be stored in a default area to be backed up by default. Part two, where are you going to actually store the data? So we talked already about storing it out in the cloud. So it might be something like integrated in with your operating system, Microsoft OneDrive or Apple iCloud. You could also use something like Dropbox or Google Drive as well. There are also some dedicated backup services that have integrated storage in their cloud to store your data. You could even use a personal server of your own, like a Star9 server. The only thing to be careful about here is if your personal server is in the same house with your main computer, backing up to your personal server is probably not going to be the right answer because the same disaster, a flood, fire, theft, whatever it might be, could take out both your systems, your system and your backup. One of the best things about cloud storage is that it is off-site. So if something happens in your house, in your office, you are protected. The downside on it typically is that it's a large amount of data. It's going to take a lot longer generally to upload and to recover the files as well. And as I said before, the cloud is just someone else's server. You need to make sure that if you're going to back up to the cloud that you do encrypt that data to protect it. If you're putting on local storage, it could be just an external hard drive, could be something as simple as a USB stick, a micro SD card, whatever that could be. Important to remember when you copy your backup to the external device that you then remove that external device so you don't have your backup standing right on top of your computer. You then want to put it into a different location, at a minimum into a fireproof box, a safe, your mother's house, something else like that, but someplace separate so if something happens to your main computer, you still have your backup. Often what people will do is they will rotate between two different drives for added security. So they'll take the backup and put it away, then they'll have a separate drive, second drive, make a second backup as well, and rotate those through. Two is one, one is none, and three is for me. So for me, I generally do two local copies that I swap, and I do a cloud backup as well for that extra redundancy on that. All right. Third part is what software do you want to use? So it's possible to use the built-in software. Again, that's got some limitations, but in general, if you're not doing anything else, start there, get that going. There's also a number of all-in-one services. I've used SpiderOak One. There's Acronis, Carbonite, iDrive. There's a number of these different backup services that will install on your computer, allow you to back them up, schedule the backups, and send it up to their cloud and store it all. There will be a cost to that, but it will protect your data, and you can get support on that everything else. There are also some open source solutions that I particularly like. One is called Free File Sync. It lets you create profiles so that you can specify the list of folders and files to copy and those destinations. It can go to local drives or cloud synced folders. Very easy to schedule. And it's really nice because it actually has the exact same folder structure in the destination as in the as your main computer. So if you're looking for something, you can just kind of browse through real easy and see it. The other one I like, also open source, is Duplicati. It is more sophisticated. It does a lot of compression, and it stores the backups in a special format. So it's not quite as easy to see the documents. You have to use their special software to do a retrieval, to do a restore. But it has a much better compression ratio, and therefore your backups don't have to be quite as large. Again, easy to schedule and open source, very solid there. Finally, most important part, test your backups. Whatever your backup strategy is, after you're done with your test with your backup, make sure you actually try retrieving some of those documents. Make sure you know how to get them back. If you've got a backup and there's no error message that says it completed okay, you still don't really know that you can retrieve that document. You've got to do that test, make sure you can do the retrieval. Finally, in closing, it can be a confusing topic. There are a lot of options. So in summary, do something to start. If you're not backing up, back up. If you are backing it up, check to see, are you backing up exactly what you want to? Is there anything that you might be missing? And definitely test retrieving those backups. You can improve it over time. This has been Jesse Markowitz with yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. If you have further questions on this or any other topics, please feel free to reach out to me or ask as a question for Jack.
So my personal favorite for this is, I guess you'd call it an off-the-shelf software as a service or ASP type service for a monthly fee, and it's Carbonite. And I do believe in offsite backups, and I think that offsite backups are important because of all the reasons Jesse just gave you. And what I like about Carbonite is it's not really like a gigabyte thing. It's a device. It's a number of devices. And their plus plan, which is only $6.50 a month, it's only a little bit more than their basic plan, which is like $80 a year. It's less than $80 a year to back your data up. And it's for one computer and one external hard drive. Well, I have a 4 terabyte external hard drive, so I guess I got 4 terabytes storage with Carbonite. I don't know if there's a limit, but whatever it is, I haven't hit it yet. It all works. And then when you set that up, you have an external hard drive. You link that to your Carbonite. You get automatic backups there, and you back up all your devices to that hard drive. And you probably have one machine that's like your main working machine. You make that your machine that goes to Carbonite as well. So you have your computer and your external hard drive both backing up to Carbonite, and you back up all your other devices to that external hard drive, which then backs up to Carbonite for $80 a month. And I like open source solutions and all. I may look into some other options, but I think that's a really simple solution. And this is the other thing you guys know that I've talked about before when I recommend services and products and stuff. I am not your customer support person. And if I recommend something that doesn't have customer support, then you say, "Hey, Jack, how do I do this?" And I don't know. I can't. I'm sorry. I can't. It's not that I don't care. It's not that in the end I'm unwilling to help a person. It's that, bro, I don't have time to be customer support for Bitcoin wallets, Bitcoin nodes, backup systems, GPTs. I don't. So I try to recommend things with also good customer service, or at least reasonable customer service, because I can't be your CSR, and I don't want to be. All right, and you can't afford, I'll pay you. Okay, you ain't going to like the bill. I'm going to be like a lawyer, $600 an hour, minimum 15-minute billing increments, which means if you call me for 1 minute, it's going to be, $150. I'm serious. So that's why I recommend off-the-shelf stuff. All right, with that, let's go ahead and talk about something that I think is interesting, and it plays into something I'm going to be talking about more about, which is rules for radicals. And I say for the right when I talk about this, and I may keep doing it for the very reasons that these things work, because you use the language people understand versus accurate language at times. Okay? I know that sounds twisty, but that's what the left does, and that's what works. Right? How many people bought, something because it was faster than the other thing when it didn't matter? A router for your house, but all you were really concerned with is the speed of your internet connection. Doesn't matter how fast your local area network is if your WAN sucks ass, right? Your wide area network. Especially back in the days of original DSL when it was 1.45 megabits and it's this router's 100 megabits. Doesn't matter if all you're worried about is getting shit off the internet because you have to go through that thinner pipe, but people bought it anyway, right? People make decisions based on words and terminology, so I'll continue with that until I come up with a better way to put it. Because rules for radicals really is about taking power from those who have it, and the left, the reason you say for the right is because the left's been doing it for 70 years or more now. And they've made it their Bible, and you should read the enemy's playbook because they're using it against you. But one of the things they're doing right now, so we just had this lunatic climb up on a roof and shoot a guy for no reason other than what he had to say and because what he said was effective and was winning hearts and minds. That's what happened. He was a leftist. He killed a right-wing guy because he hated him. The end, infinity. We don't really know. Yes, you do, you lying fucks. But what else do they do? They'll come up with an alternative narrative. They don't present it as an alternative narrative. They just present it as a narrative that is alternative. What do I mean by that? What's going on right now? Well, actually, according to statistics, turns out that the right commits more acts of physical violence than the left. Political violence, not physical violence. Political violence than the left. This is bullshit, even with some statistical fanciness and rearrangement. We all know this. There was a massive amount of political violence that happened during Black Lives Matter. And what the hell? And you look at this graph, and it literally does show, because the graph can show what you tell it to show, more acts of political violence by the left by the right than the left. Then you read something really important, little tiny stuff at the bottom of the graph. And what did it say? It's based on convictions. Convictions. These are people who committed acts of political violence that were convicted in court. Well, we had to do it that way. That's because they're innocent until proven guilty. Turns out, though, to be convicted, you must first be charged, and then you must be prosecuted. So we know that there's massive amounts of political violence from the left, throwing rocks at ICE agents. Literally, Trump just talked about this, and he's right, whether you like him or not. When the bricks and shit got taken away, because they would have these demonstrations, and magically, pallets of bricks would show up. The FBI, local PD, etc., started going, hey, we don't know who owns those bricks. Let's just bring a forklift out here. And they started taking them away. These assholes go out with freaking hammers and start breaking curbs and sidewalks and handing out chunks of concrete. They then throw them at federal agents as though that's not political violence. Maybe they get arrested. Doesn't go on the graph. Maybe they get a fine or something if they don't actually go to trial and get convicted. Doesn't go on the graph. Stage one, you just stack the deck in favor of the left, because the left doesn't get prosecuted, because the left commits most of its act of political violence where? In leftist cities, as I've always said, because it's retarded until you look at it that way. If you went and committed your leftist political violence in Fort Worth, Texas, a Fort Worth PD will round your fucking ass up, and a Tarrant County prosecutor will put your ass in state prison up in Pampa. So don't do it there. Go over to Dallas where you're going to get a pass. That's how it works, right out of the gate. But wait, there's more. Well, what exactly is being defined as political violence here? Turns out whoever put the little graph and study together, whatever they decided was. There's no real rhyme or reason to it. For instance, in one instance, a dude that was a legit Nazi, like Aryan Nation Nazi, who had been to prison several times with legitimate, like full-on swastika tattoos on his body, killed his brother, and his brother was gay. Political violence. Now, I don't know if you know much about the Aryan Nation. They're not exactly a politically active group, and killing your brother, whether he's gay or not, over an argument in your home is probably not an act of political violence, but hey, it stacks the deck in our favor, so let's include it in the data. Kind of like you include in the data, a dude kills himself on a motorcycle in a wreck, but he tested positive for COVID, so we'll call it a death with COVID. You see how that works. Same shit, different day. And I could go on. But the bigger lesson here is what? Everybody's saying it in the media. It's all over social media. People look at the graph and they believe it. Rules for radicals. You notice what they didn't say? They really didn't say, well, actually, it's implied. What the left is brilliant at, even though they're lying, thieving pieces of shit, but what they're brilliant at is making an accusation independent of the accusation that was made to them. Sure, the accusation's made, and that triggers the response, but what does the right do? The right does well, actually. The right does what I just do. We logically explain why it's bullshit. And all the people who already knew it was bullshit go, rah, 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 yeah, yeah, yeah. And all the people that believe the counter-narrative, the bullshit narrative, go, blah. I don't care. Why? Too many words. Too many words. If you want to sell an idea, you need to distill it down to no more than a sentence. three words is even better. Just like branding a company. Just like branding a company. So one way you cut words out of your message is stop talking about the other side. Or talking about your side. I'm sorry, only talk about the other side. You just cut your words in half. What we're trying to do is this, and what they're trying to do is that. See how many words there are? What they're trying to do is this. Done. Done. And you can intimidate with rules for radicals, or you can make the others, you can make the populace intimidated by your enemy. You could do either. You could make the left afraid of the right, or you can make the general population afraid of the left. But you pick one, and you do one at a time. I know this all sounds dirty and nasty and things that we don't do because we're better than that. You're losing. You're losing. You have no power. What Rules for Radicals is really about, as I told you this week, is those who do not have power taking the power from those who do. And dare I say, it's actually very Jeffersonian, as in Thomas Jefferson. Remember one of Thomas Jefferson's most famous and I believe least understood quotes of all time is what? The tree of liberty must be from time to time watered with the blood of patriots and tyrants. May have got a word or two wrong there, but that's the basics of it. We must water the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots and tyrants from time to time. What does that really mean? Hey, the patriots won! Yay! If you'll read Rules for Radicals instead of believing what the people on YouTube say about it, you'll find something out. One of the very first things Saul Alinsky kills in that book is the Nirvana view, the Disney view of, and they lived happily ever after. This never happens in human history. At no point did any group of people live happily ever after. It never occurred. In World War II, before World War II, the Soviet Union was the enemy. During World War II, they were our allies, and they were noble, and God was on their side. And the enemy was Japan, Italy, and Germany. And God wanted them smited. And after we smited them, they immediately became our allies, and Russia became our enemy. And they went off to being god-awful and all the other horrible things. Because in the time, in the situation, the means to achieve victory required both of those things. So there was no happily ever after. And the next thing we did is put multiple times high-level Nazis in charge of NATO. Look it up if you think that I'm wrong. There is no happily ever after. So what did Jefferson mean? From time to time, the Tree of Liberty must be watered with the blood of patriots and tyrants. Well, have you ever heard this? Power corrupts. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. Upton Sinclair. I'm sure you have. Do you know that's a misquote? Not misattribution, misquote. The accurate quote. Power tends to corrupt. And absolute power corrupts, absolutely. What do we take from that? Jeffersonian and Rules for Radicals, taking power from those that have them to the have-nots. Jefferson, when he made that statement, was acknowledging that no matter how noble the cause was, the group that took power would obtain power, and then very shortly after it, go away from all the wonderful, beautiful ideas that it used to get everybody on board with it becoming powerful and begin to tend toward corruption, and eventually when it became strong enough and powerful enough, become absolutely corrupt. And the only way to continue humanity on an advancement toward more and more freedom and liberty would be for the other side to then take power. And this would have to go back and forth over time. It not always had to be done with blood to the tree, but it had to be done. A ratchet effect. Advance forward, pull back, advance forward again. It has to happen. The people without power must seize it to make change, because the people with power will stay entrenched. The haves wish to keep what they have, and therefore they will continue to advance what they have. This is the reality that we find ourselves in. And you have been duped into believing the fact that, you know, the Congress is Democrat, now it's Republican, the White House is Democrat, now it's Republican, right? Like, that's the balance of power being shifted back and forth, and it isn't. I think I've made enough of a case for you this week, or case to you this week. The most power in this country is in organizations that are not elected officials. It is first and foremost the power that is in academia. And academia is K-12 education. It's the university system. It's the research scientists. It's all of academia. We shape the mind of children from the time they're 5 years old all the way up until they're ready for the grave by telling them, experts say. And it all comes from academia. Power apparatus number one. The right has almost no power. None within academia. Power apparatus number two. And it's a close second. It's very close to first itself. The media. The right has almost no power in media, even with organizations like Newsmax and Fox News. Again, as long as you have a Dr. Mark Siegel and that General Jack Keane coming onto Fox News to give you the narrative about, oh, Israel is our strongest and best ally ever. There's 50 states and one Israel. Like, as long as you have that shit, right, you don't have power in media. You just think you do because they like the orange man. At least they don't hate him as bad as MSNBC does and Rachel Maddow. Or you have Dr. Mark Siegel. Yeah, your children should get it. You should get all the vaccines. Right? Like, and then the Pfizer commercial comes on with fat people line dancing. Right? No. You have no power in media. No power in academia, no power in media. I would say the next level of power, and on some cases you could make that it is the ultimate power, is the power over money. The banks control the money. The banking system is not run by conservatives, even though the TV that's run by liberals tells you that it is. Right? That's just a nice way of misdirecting things. The people that run the banking system, they're not liberal or conservative. They're not left or right. They are simply haves that wish to always have, and they manipulate the money, and a very small group of them get to decide how much money costs you, and how much they'll devalue the money that you already have by this year, and how many people need to be fired this year because the economy's doing too well. And it's getting in the way of our inflation targets, which we never hit anyway. So then you've got the banking system, which is largely made up of neither. Neither. But it will do what it's necessary to keep the public from going nuts and killing everyone, because the people in power never want a revolution. Okay? Never. Revolution is always bad for the people in power. That's why the people in power always refer to revolutionaries as insurrectionists and savages and what have you. Then the next level of power you have in this is government. But it is not the elected official. It is the bureaucrat. It is the person appointed to a position, keeps their job for 40 or 50 years, that makes and sets policy with no real control mechanism over them. And when an orange man comes in and puts a tiny little bit of control, they lose their fucking mind, and who backs them up? The media and the academics. You see how it all works? You have no power. Get away from the illusion that you do. Understand they have the power, and that means it is time to fight in a way that you might refer to as dirty. But the ends are justified by the means when the situation is taken into account. Here's an example. In 1945, the United States created a second sun in Japan. And then a couple days later, we did it again. This sparked a massive debate. Should we or should we not have used it? The debate goes on still to this day. One side says more people would have died. And the other side says Japan was on its last legs anyway. It was unnecessary. Had the United States had the atomic bomb in 1941, when Japan initially attacked Pearl Harbor, and the U.S. military was not on any footing, and we were not sitting with an air base just, you know, where we could bomb Japan every day and they couldn't really touch us, had at that time, when the future was uncertain, the United States dropped the bomb, we wouldn't even have had the debate. It was because, and if you want to take it to a real extreme, the firebombing of Dresden. The British had firebombed Dresden in 1939. No one would have batted an eye. Doing it on the eve of total surrender was considered a war crime, and it was. Everything is subjective to the time and the place. And when you're going to lose, you need to look at the stakes. And what's at stake right now? I'll leave that to you. But I think it's time that we truly do TDAO. Those days are over. TDAO. It's a hashtag I'm dropping everywhere. I encourage you to drop it as well. The days of pretending that we're the good guys for the sake of being the good guys, only to constantly lose, need to be over, or it's going to all be over, and they're going to get complete and total control of the last vestiges of what was once a great republic. That's really where we are today. That's really where we are. We will never actually have an America First president until we fix the media and academia. We don't have an America First president. Right now what you have is welfare to the university system from the orange man by importing more Indians for student visas and from all over the world. It's college it's welfare for the college system. Trump's dude admitted it on TV. Well, you know, like because the guy said, like, well, we have American citizens who should be going to Stanford or Harvard or Yale, and these positions are being taken by people from China. And it was one of Trump's goons said, you know, well, you know what the president's doing here is if you got rid of that, it seems good, but then everybody moves up a level and your bottom tier universities just go out of business because they're fucking supposed to, idiot. But no. So you do not have an America First president. You do not have an America First government. You damn sure do not have an America First Congress or Senate. So even where you think you are in power right now, you are powerless. Wake up to that reality. Start acting like it. I'm not saying to go out and get in a bell tower and do something stupid and violent. I'm saying we need to organize with the mindset of a radical. Because the radical is the one who realizes we must seize power because we do not have it. And we have failed to do that because we believe we either have it or we're just this close. We're not. All right, with that, hope you enjoyed today's show. Hope you take what I have to say seriously. I hope you have a great weekend. And I hope you remember, if you want to come to the fall workshop, you're running out of time. Tomorrow night, it will go away like a fart in the wind, and it will not come back. It is... It's a great experience. I promise you, you'll love it. And I'd love to meet you there. And I'm going to tell you that if you've never been to one, you'll learn a lot from the presenters. You'll have a lot of fun. And you will eat really well for the cost alone. I mean, the food is probably worth the cost. We really go all out to try to make it that way. But the value will be the new connections and contacts you make. And some of those connections and contacts have led to some pretty amazing things in the real world. You won't understand until you come. It is different than even events that look very similar. It is different. I tried to do it on purpose. I'm not sure that I did. I think this community made it what it is. And it has become something pretty amazing. And that's why even though we just can't do them at our property anymore, we went the extra mile to find a venue so that we can keep doing them because we don't want them to ever go away. Please consider coming. You can just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and I will make sure that the post that lets you sign up will be right below today's episode, which of course is 3,734. With that, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.